I'm John Merriman, and this is History 202. And so I'm here every Monday and Wednesday, 10:30 to 11:20. And the way this course is, that these are all really major themes, and I'm going to go over this a little bit, and I'm going to talk about some of the themes. And I kind of lecture on things that I think are, that complement what you're doing. Let me give you an example. When I talk about imperialism, the new imperialism, why it is that Europe basically took over the entire world between the 1880s and 1914. If you can read the chapter in History of Modern Europe, which I had fun writing, but I lecture on the Boy Scouts. And I often say that I lecture on the Boy Scouts because I was thrown out of the Boy Scouts in Portland, Oregon when I was a kid because I didn't manage to accumulate a single badge and was totally useless after sports seasons ended. But that's not why I do it, because to understand the new imperialism, one has to, why Europe took over essentially all of Africa, that places were totally uncharted, suddenly became highly contested between British, French, and German and Italian conquerors, that one has to understand that the culture of imperialism and the origins of the Boy Scouts in Britain has a lot to do with that. Why generations of British youth and their counterparts in Germany and even Australia, New Zealand, and other places began to think that it was important to be able to look at a map in their schoolhouse that had the color red for Britain, increasingly taking over the map of Europe and lots of other places, I mean of Asia and Africa and lots of other places as well. So instead of at the very beginning of that lecture, I'll say, look, there are three things you really ought to know about the new imperialism, why they did this, and then I talk about the Boy Scouts, so that those two things will fit together. Or when I talk about World War I, and we'll have two lectures, my friend and colleague Jay Winter is doing one of them on the Great War in modern memory. I instead of trying to do the entire war, and there's I think quite sporty chapter on that in the book, I'll talk about trench warfare. And you'll see a film called Paths of Glory, an early Kubrick film about the mutinies in 1917, and I'll talk about the mutinies in 1917 when people just said enough is enough, you know, there's no sense dying for nothing, we won't go over the top. So which is to say that it's important to come to lecture and it's important to come to sections. I've cut back on the reading. I used to use about four more books than I use now, but it's better to concentrate on what you're doing. The books are A History of Modern Europe, which I basically, the second edition, which I wrote for people like you. And then you'll read Persian Letters, not all of it, that would be a rather lengthy day or so. You'll read excerpts in Persian Letters, and Montesquieu, you know, talks about relations between West and East, and it's really, you know, it's a phenomenal moment in the history of the Enlightenment. Then you have a pause where you're basically just reading me, for better or for worse, but I hope for better, until you get to Émile Zola, his great novel, Germinal, which is a classic. And Zola was the first sort of naturalist novelist, at least in France. And when he wrote Germinal means budding, like the budding of trees, but he means the budding of people being aware of themselves as workers. He went down to the mines in the north of France in Anzin. And one of the heroes of the book is a woman called Catherine, who is 15 years old, but has seen a lot of life for being 15 years old. And when Zola wrote Germinal, he went down into the mines to look at 15-year-old young women, barely older than girls, working in the mines 12 hours a day. So it's a book that just, you know, it resounds with reality, and it's really kind of an amazing book. And I think you'll like that. I hope you will. And then Helmut Smith's The Butcher's Tale is about accusations of ritual murder in a German town. It's about the Second German Reich, and it's about anti-Semitism in a small place with bigger consequences. George Orwell went off to fight the good fight in Spain during the Spanish Civil War, where it was sort of a dry run for an even more horrible war, an even more horrible fascist. And it's about his engagement and disillusionment in the Spanish Republican forces the Loyalist forces and about the tensions and the duplicity of Stalin's folks undercutting the Trotskyists and undercutting the anarchists. And it's one of those classics. It's a classic for a very good reason. It's really a marvelous read. And finally, there's Ordinary Men. I go to Poland a lot in the last couple of years. I've been there four or five times for various reasons, and I'd never been to Auschwitz. And I went to Auschwitz a year ago. I don't know, some of you have probably been there. And as you're going through this, the horror of it all, and as you're seeing empty suitcases with people's names on them that people don't exist anymore, and you're seeing baby shoes and things like that, you think, who could have done this? Who could have gone out and simply, in an assembly line way, killed people? Or in fields around Łódź, which was a large industrial town, still is in Poland, simply gone out and blown the brains out of mothers, babies, grandmothers, and anybody they found. Who could have done it? Well, the answer that Chris Browning has is Ordinary Men. And he had the quite brilliant idea of looking at a German unit, essentially policemen from Hamburg, the port town of Hamburg, old important Hanseatic port, and he follows them from the lives of very ordinary people into the killing fields, it was nothing less than that, of Poland. You know, and it's also short. Germinal is long, but these other ones are short. And it's also, you know, it's gripping. It's quite amazing. So those are the books. I think The History of Modern Europe, I hope it's fun to read. I think you'll enjoy that. And the lectures kind of, you see the themes speak for themselves. Sections, everybody likes Wednesday night sessions. One of my colleagues has only Wednesday night sections. And we've gone increasingly to that because sometimes you don't find a large audience on even on Friday morning 10:30 slots. We've abandoned that. So tentatively, we're going to have 2 at 7, 2 at 8, and then Thursday at 1:30 p.m. And Thursday at 2:30 p.m. And I don't know, when are we starting sections? Sometimes we don't do it till the second week. It depends on what day. What day is this? Wednesday. So I don't know. Maybe we'll start them next week. Maybe we won't. Who knows? But they will happen. And there's also a short, sporty paper assignment. And by short, I don't mean 2 pages, but something like 7 pages, 8 pages on something that you want to write about. Now let me give you some examples, just you know, off the top of my head. If you have any interest in painting, for example, it would be interesting to take looks by, say, the two impressionist painters like Pizarro and Renoir, and to see how they viewed the transformation of 19th century Paris, the big boulevards, and all of that. Or you could take another novel. I mean, Germinal, one of the interesting things about it is that it's a document of history. You know, it's a novel, so these are invented people, but it's a document of history in some ways, as is lots of the great literature on World War I. And there isn't any period in modern history that has so much gripping literature about it as the Great War. You know, the British war poets like Siegfried Sassoon. And a lot of these people were dead after they wrote, Sassoon wasn't, at least immediately. I can't remember if he dies in 1918 or not. But to take some of the poetry or the writing of the war and write a paper about it. Or if you're into diplomatic history or something like that. I mean, I don't know, I wouldn't counsel a paper reevaluating the origins of the Crimean War. That might put you to sleep before it puts your TA to sleep. But you know, you could imagine a good paper on that. I mean, you can do whatever you want. One of the lectures, when I do the Enlightenment, borrowing from my good friend Bob Darnton, I'll do a thing at the beginning about why the Enlightenment was important and what it is. There's secularization, rational inquiry, and all of that, stuff that you may already know. Maybe not, but it's in the book. But then what I do is I look at some of the third string, kind of, or the third division in the European football sense of Enlightenment hacks, and what they wrote about royalty and about aristocrats. And the way they kind of undermined those traditional hierarchies that would be swept away to a large extent by the French Revolution. Or you could take somebody out of the French Revolution, such as the steely Saint-Just, who ran off with his mother's silver at age 16 or something and went on the grand tour of France, and talk about him and the Committee of Public Safety that signed away the lives of lots of people, but may have also saved the revolution. You can do whatever you want. It should have something to do with the course, and in the time period we're talking about. I mean, nothing on the Red Sox or something, but you would work with your teaching participant, and I'm an email animal. I'm always available on email, and I have office hours as well, though people don't come to them much anymore. I'm sitting there doing NBA.com because email has made office hours sort of oblivious. I mean, irrelevant, not oblivious, but people are oblivious to my office hours. But anyway, they are Mondays 1 to 2:30. Used to be 3, but I just sit there by myself. 1 to 2:30 in Brantford College, K-13. There are also two other movies. When we get to fascism, when we get to Adolf Hitler, he was only one of a whole bunch of dictators. There was hardly any parliamentary regimes left in continental Europe by the time 1939 comes. A woman called Leni Riefenstahl, who just died in 2002 at age 102, when she was a young woman, did a propaganda film for Hitler. And Hitler, like Mussolini, believed in high tech. He was one of the first people to use the radio. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt used the fireside chat of the radio. But Mussolini was already there, piling falsehood upon falsehood, and Italians who couldn't barely afford to eat all had their radios, and the same thing happened in Germany as well. And she did a documentary called Triumph of the Will about Nuremberg. And it is truly chilling. It's an amazing, it looks like a political convention or something in some ways. And it's all these movies you can see in the privacy of your luxurious suites in Brantford or Pearson College or wherever, because they're available now in ways that I don't even understand, but on your internet. We used to actually show them here. I used to use this movie, a great movie called The Sorrow and the Pity, the Chagrin, la Pitié, and it was 4 hours long, and people described it as a 2 6-pack movie. And the janitors complained because there's so many beer bottles rattling around. Of course, this was before the drinking age was lowered, or was raised. So of course, I don't show that movie. I take that back. I don't take that back. But what the hell? But anyway, I don't show that movie anymore. But I do show Triumph of the Will, and you can watch that at home. And the other one is Au revoir les enfants, because one of the last lectures I talk about resistance and collaboration in Europe. And because I live in France much of the time, I talk about France. And Au revoir les enfants, some of you, goodbye children, some of you have probably seen. It was made by Louis Malle, who just died a couple years ago. And it was about when he was collège, he was equivalent of 7th and 8th grade. And there's a new boy shows up at school during World War II in Fontainebleau, which is just east of Paris. And he's a boy who hadn't been there before. And he's a Jewish boy. And it's about his friendship with this boy and what happens, at the end. It's not a happy film, but it's a great, great film. What else? But to say, there's a midterm. I don't like to waste a lecture giving a midterm. I would rather give a lecture, but we have to have something to report to you. If you don't do very well at all, we don't count it as much as if you do well. People ask these questions. I know, how much is it worth? Well, I mean, geez, there's more to life than grades, but it's something like 25%, and the paper's 25%, and section participation is 10%, whatever we work out, and then the final. So it's just it's an exercise in seeing how you're doing, and it really is no big deal, but it will help you pull the themes of the course together. And it's no scary situation. I mean, we all live in this sort of A minus B plus range. I'll tell you, a couple years ago, I ran into this student. When I run into students, I'm a friendly guy, and I see people, I say, "Hi, well, how are you? How are you?" And I ran into this one person and said, "Hi, how are you?" And she went, "Oh, hello." Oh. And I remembered her name, and I went and looked it up, and there was the B plus. And it wasn't that "hi, how are you?" A minus or A one, but I mean, whatever. I'm sure she had all A's in the other courses, and a B plus is not the end of the world. And most people get A's, but whatever. But you have to take the midterm. That's the way they run it here, and it's not my idea. So that's what we're going to do. Okay. Now I'm going to talk about themes. Some of the themes, and then at the end I'm going to read you a poem, because I started history in a way. In a serious way, because I read this poem, so I'll leave that until the end of it. I didn't go to Yale. I went to the University of Michigan. maize and blue forever. Very sad since last weekend. I came from Portland, Oregon. I don't know if anyone came from Portland, Oregon, but that's where I'm from. And when I went off to Michigan, I'd been at a Jesuit high school. And Jesuit high schools, it was a sports factory in part, but it was a very good school, but it was very repressive. And I went off to the University of Michigan after having been in Jesuit school for 4 years. And it was wine, women, and song. There weren't enough of them in the middle, and probably too much of the first. And my first semester, I got a 1.93 grade point average. And my mother asked me if that was on a two-point scale. You know, I'm serious. And I had an F. I mean, I shouldn't laugh at myself. And my kids say, "Oh my God, not the same story again." But I got an F, and I got two C's, and I got a B. And the people I hung around with in Ann Arbor were so unaccomplished, some of them anyway, that they thought I was smart because I got a B. They say, I'd go by the dining room, he got a B. And they asked me to tutor them. Can you imagine that? And so, I mean, some of the people that I hung around with were amazing. You may even know people like that, but I don't think so. But one of the guys that I knew, I got to get back to the topic in a minute, but I just thought of this, was sort of the king of malapropisms. And one day he was going on and on. This is the people I hung around with. He was going on and on about this good meal that he'd had, you know, of one course after another, and it was fantastic, and it was a really good restaurant, and you know, somebody had snuck him some wine. And finally, I mean, I was sort of tired of the whole thing, and I said, "Was it gratis?" And he said, "No, it was chicken." And so those are the people that I hung around with at the University of Michigan. But I've taught here a long time, and I stand by maize and blue, but I love Yale, and one of the things I love about Yale is being able to teach people like you, and I mean it, and I love this course, so I hope that you will enjoy it if indeed you take it. Now, what about some of the themes? What kind of stuff are we going to do? Could you get some a syllabi for some of those folks back there? Be great. They're up on the thing. Thanks a lot. A couple themes. I don't believe, and I've never believed, that history is a series of bins. I guess I wrote that in the book, but that you open up and you say, well, there goes Enlightenment. Shut that baby down. Then you open up the next one, and here comes 18th century rivalries, and you shut that baby, and then French Revolution, well, I know all about that now. Pretty soon you go on to Russian Revolution eventually and all that. That, you know, to do a course like this where you're going to learn much of what is important to know about Western civilization, I do believe, if you do the reading and stuff, and if you enjoy the lectures, there have to be some threads that, you know, that go all the way through that make it worth it, so you learn something. And one is certainly state making, because even if you take a sort of federalized, decentralized state, like with this very bizarre electoral system, like the United States, that the growth of modern states, you know, it doesn't really just come in the 20th century with the welfare state beginning in England, and even before that in some other places, insurance programs and things like that. It begins with the consolidation of state power in the late Middle Ages with territorial monarchies, the Spanish and the French and the English monarchies. It has a lot to do with the growth of absolute rule, and that's what I'm going to talk about next time, absolute rule. Absolutism, the growth of standing armies, huge standing armies, never seen before, of forts, big forts built on frontiers. It has a lot to do with bureaucrats who can extract resources from ordinary people while the rich didn't pay anything or hardly anything at all. It has to do with an allegiance, a dynastic allegiance that could be transferred later to a nation, the idea of a nation, and that starts in the 18th century. It doesn't start in the 19th century. It starts in the 18th century, at least in England, and that's an argument that in Britain, and that's an argument that we'll make also. You know, in 1500, which is kind of when that book gets rolling, though you only start in about 1648, there was about 1,500 different territorial units in Europe. And some were no bigger than an archbishop's garden in Germany, and some were larger states, not yet what they are now in terms of size, such as France, which expanded under Louis XIV into, you know, Alsace and Lorraine and various other places. But there's about 1,500 territorial units. In 1890, there were 30. And so the consolidation of state power, which is looking at it from the state out, or the emergence of an identity where you see yourself as German as opposed to Bavarian, French as opposed to Gascon or Provençal, Spanish as opposed to Castilian, or as opposed to Catalan. The Catalan language was illegal until 1975, until Francisco Franco finally croaked in 1975 in November. Somebody, this is a great phrase, I wish I had said it originally, I don't know who said it, but someone once said that a language is a dialect with a powerful army. And that's it, that's true. France, at the time of the French Revolution, half the people in France knew French. There was bilingualism, you could know Catalan, you could know Auvergnat Patois. We live in the south of France where a lot of people, old people, still speak of Patois, though that's mostly dying out. And how does it come that identity, a sense of allegiance to a state or a country? Not everybody, but how does it come to 1914 when people marching off to get killed, singing the Marseillaise, the French national anthem, in pretty good French? How does that happen? How does the state increase its reach? How does the modern world, how is it created? We call this process, it's a clumsy word, but state making. How do states form? And the other side of this is, how do identities change? If you, in the 16th century, 17th century, you ask somebody who you were, say, who are you? And they would say, well, I am so-and-so, I'm of this family. Or I am Protestant, if it was the 16th century or late 16th century, or anytime after 1520s, 1530s in parts of Germany, I'm Protestant, I am Jewish. In much of the Balkans, I am Muslim. In most of Europe, I am Catholic. In Eastern Europe, I am Russian Orthodox. I live in the village, Mir, M-I-R, in Russia. How does it happen that by the end of the 19th century, people have, in Russia, as they're starving to death, starving in the famine that Tolstoy, the great writer, called the world's attention to. A lot of them died in fields, thinking only if the Tsar only knew that we were starving and that his ministers were treating us bad, how angry he would be. Well, they didn't get it, that they didn't know that the Tsar could have given one damn. But the allegiance to the Tsar, the sense of being Russian, or being dominated by the Russian Tsar, is something that had to be constructed as a way. So the state constructs its ability to extract taxes, extract bodies for national armies, also to provide resources, but identities are transformed. And so I give this as an example because state making is one of the themes that kind of ties everything together. And this course ends in 1945, but look at the problems in the post-communist world of state making. And look what's going on in Georgia, which is more complicated than the newspapers present in very many ways. Or look what the horror show of the Balkans in the 1990s. So a lot of the issues, religious hatreds that we thought only would be limited to Northern Ireland, that's another theme that's very important through the whole thing. Another, of course, is economic change. Obviously, this is not a course in economic history, but the rise of capitalism, that's what it's called, capitalism, or large-scale industrialization. It changes in ways that we'll suggest in the reading, and then I'll talk about a little bit, the way people live in very fundamental ways. There's lots of continuities, but there's lots of big changes. Everybody doesn't end up in the assembly lines right away, and there are other ways of rural production, women's work remains terribly, terribly important. And I'll spend some time doing that. A very dear friend of mine, my mentor indeed, Chuck Tilley, who just died a couple months ago, to my great sadness, once said that it's bitter hard to write the history of remainders. And so lots of people who are left out of all of this. I'll do one lecture when I talk about popular protest, and I'll take three examples of people rebelling. And I stand back and said, what does this mean? What is going on here? I take the example from the Pyrenees Mountains, a place called the Ariège. We're not responsible for that. That name would never be. But where suddenly men dressed as women, carrying guns or carrying pitchforks, came down out of the mists, out of the snow, and drove away charcoal burners and drove away forest guards. Why? Because they'd lost access to glean, to pasture their miserable animals. Because the wealthy, big surprise, got the law on their side as the price of wood goes up. They didn't walk around and say, well, I'm a remainder. Eventually, I'm going to have to move to Toulouse, and my great-great-grandchildren will work in the aerospatial, in the air industry there. They didn't say, I'm remainder number 231. But they fought for their dignity and for a sense of moral of justice that they thought existed at one time that had been taken away by these economic changes they couldn't control. And then I take an example from the south of England from the same time, 1829, 1830, when they find people that dead with only dandelions in their stomach, dead of hunger. And then these people start marching, the poor, the wretched poor, rural laborers start marching and threatening people with threshing machines. Why threshing machines? Because threshing machines was taking away their work as harvesters. And one day they found a sign that said, revenge from thee is on the wing, from thy determined captain's swing. Suggested that there were many. They were righteous. They were just. They were armed. They were ready. Did Captain Swing exist? Of course not. They were weak, and they get lost. They get defeated. Some of them are hung. Lots of them are sent to Tasmania, to the prison at Port Arthur, Tasmania. They're sent to Australia. That's why when the Australians play the English, a lot of the Australians sing, you know, that old Beatles song, Yellow Submarine, which you don't remember, which I vaguely remember. We all live in a convict colony, a convict colony, a convict colony. Captain Swing, they lost, but they went down fighting. And it's bitter hard to write the history of remainders. But when you look up from that, you say, look, what's going on here? When you look at people fighting for grain, fighting for food, they're fighting against a larger process that they can't control. But it tells you a lot what's going on over the big picture. So that's another one. And then there is just, I'll just take one more, maybe another 10 minutes. I'm going to read you my poem, and then you can go, but I hope you come back. War as a dynamic of change. The 18th century is, well, warfare changes with Napoleon. There were already changes in the 18th century, but it was still basically professional armies or people getting conscripted in the British Navy because they were drunk at the wrong place at the wrong time outside of a tavern in Portsmouth or something. The next thing they know, they're throwing up on a ship, bobbing off toward the English Empire. But warfare changes with the nation state. The French called it a levée en masse, the sort of mass conscription, the sense of defending the nation. And there's this magic moment where the artisans of Paris defeat the highly professionalized army at a windmill called Valmy in the east of France. And it changes the way things were. Napoleon is arguably the first total war because of a war against civilians where there are no longer the traditional limits between fighting against civilians and fighting against against armies. And those limits hadn't existed in the 30 Years' War, and I'll talk a little bit about that next time around. But the wars are very different. You know, there's famous Goya paintings of peasants being gunned down by French soldiers and atrocities against peasants in Calabria in the south of Italy. So warfare really changes, but it becomes a dynamic of change. If you think about the Russian Revolution of 1917. The Russian Revolution was not inconceivable without World War I, but it was sort of inconceivable without the Russian Revolution of 1905 and defeat in Japan by the Japanese in an extraordinary, shocking event for at least for Europeans in 1904-1905. And World War I provides opportunities for dissidents in Russia to put forward their claims. So when the whole thing collapses on the Tsar's head in February 1917 and the Bolsheviks come to power, the war itself was a dynamic of change as well. And what a war. What wars. I mean, there had been nothing ever like it. A few journalists who had been in the Russo-Japanese War had seen trenches in Manchuria that had been built. But nobody could have imagined that the war was supposed to be over in 6 weeks, was going to destroy four empires. That is the Ottoman Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the German Empire, and the Russian Empire, and arguably, we can debate this, the British Empire, because lots of people who had fought in India, or Indians who had fought in the war, or people now we'd call Pakistanis who'd fought in the war, or people from Kenya who'd fought in the war, are no longer going to be satisfied with simply arguing that they're part of the great empire, even though they have hardly any rights and no money and simply work for the big guy. And so the war transforms Europe by destroying these empires. What it also does, and it's very possible to argue this, and my friend Jay Winter, who is a great expert on World War I, and Bruno Caban also, who's on leave this year, would agree with this. You can see the whole period, 1914, 1945, as a new and more terrible 30 years war. Because Europe is in depression all through the 1920s and 30s. Agricultural depression the whole time. Only between 1924 and 1929 is it not big industrial depression. The poisoning of the political atmosphere. I'm going to do a whole lecture on Hitler and the National Socialists, because World War I created Hitler. He was already just this pathetic guy with grandiose plans, with no friends, and sort of a sad sack going to the theater and droning on and on about all he knew about Wagner, whom he loved, and the theater, and in a threadbare coat. But World War I transforms him into an anti-Semite. He was already an anti-socialist. It transforms him into an anti-Semite. People, the troops that came back, many of them simply kept on marching. They'd survived the war, and they kept on marching. And the poisoning of the political atmosphere was something that was simply extraordinary. And you have to understand fascism, and this is terribly, terribly important. You have to understand what happens in World War I. Great expectations, dashed the Treaty of Versailles, which only the great British thinker John Maynard Keynes really got right, predicting the disaster that came out of it. If there's no more fascinating period in history, in my mind, it's absolutely fantastic. And what a war. It's all obvious. Everybody sees these films, the Imperial War Museum, which has been kind of wrecked the way they've done it now. It's sort of too high-tech, but in London. But I leave you with just a couple thoughts, that the Battle of the Somme in 1916, that started on July 1st when they blow the whistle and say, over the top, guys, there are more British soldiers killed and wounded in the first 3 days of the Battle of the Somme, S-O-M-M-E, three days, than there were Americans killed in World War I, Korea, and Vietnam combined. In 3 days. Where are the great British leaders of the 1920s and the 1930s? They're all dead. They're hung up on that old barbed wire, as one of the war poets put it. They're hung up on that old barbed wire. One guy, a soccer player, said, well, I'm going to, you know, we'll get some enthusiasm. He tries to dribble a ball across, you know, these trenches and things across the craters, and he doesn't make it. He's killed. In 1950, 1914, on Christmas Day, the Germans and the British soldiers, someone would say, enough of this stuff for the day. And they sing to each other, and they actually play soccer, they play football. 1915, a British soldier says, let's do the same thing. They put him against the wall and shoot him. The horror of the war, it transforms Europe, every aspect of Europe. It's impossible to understand the growth of the agrarian, sort of semi-fascist regimes in Eastern Europe. And very much under Nazi influence, without understanding World War I. The war that was supposed to end all wars, of course, it doesn't do that at all. And that's a big stop on our agenda as well. We used to read All Quiet on the Western Front, but everybody's read that. And then we read Robert Graves, rather long and self-indulgent, goodbye to all that. So that was pretty long, so we don't do that. But we will try to rock. Let me just read you my poem, and then you can go. You can go whatever you want, but anyway. But I remember this. I remember reading this poem back at University of Michigan on 2 o'clock on a Saturday, trying to figure out what I'd done the night before. But anyway, no. This is Brecht, the great East German poet, and it's called "A Worker Reads History." And let me begin by saying that, you know, we're going to study quote-unquote great, I mean really quote-unquote, great men, great women. Hitler is obviously not a great man, but he's awful, just awful, but the people who were thought to have made history. And Napoleon, Peter the Great, other people. I do talk about the folks that you read about in textbooks, including mine. But I ask the same question and pose to you the same question that Brecht poses. And it's a short poem, so just hang on. Who built the seven gates of Thebes? The books are filled with the names of kings. Was it kings who hauled the craggy blocks of stone? And Babylon, so many times destroyed, who built the city up each time? In which of Lima's houses, the city glittering with gold, lived those who built it. In the evening, when the Chinese Wall was finished, where did the Masons go? Imperial Rome is full of arcs of triumph. Who reared them up? Over whom did the Caesars triumph? Byzantium lives in song. Were all her dwellings palaces? And even in Atlantis, of the legend, the night the sea rushed in, the drowning men still bellowed for their slaves. Young Alexander conquered India. He alone? Caesar beat the Gauls. Was there not even a cook in his army? Philip of Spain wept as his fleet was sunk and destroyed. Were there no other tears? Frederick the Great triumphed in the Seven Years' War. Who triumphed with him? Each page a victory. At whose expense the victory ball? Every 10 years a great man. Who paid the piper? So many particulars, so many questions. And if you hang with us this semester, we'll get at some of those. See ya.
Thank you.